What is the future of green aviation? How do we share environmental solutions to unite people and change the climate narrative from sacrifice and fear to enthusiasm and hope?
Bertrand Piccard is a notable Swiss environmentalist, explorer, author, and psychiatrist. His ventures include being the first to travel around the world in a non-stop balloon flight and in a solar-powered airplane, and he is regarded as a pioneer in clean technology. Piccard is also the founder of the Solar Impulse Foundation, which has identified over 1,500 solutions that can protect the environment in a financially profitable way and connects them with investors. As a UN ambassador for the environment, his goal is to convince leaders of the viability of a zero-carbon economy, which he will demonstrate via his next emission-free project, Climate Impulse, a green hydrogen-powered airplane that can fly nonstop around the Earth.
Bertrand Piccard, welcome back to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
Pleasure to be back with you, yes.
So in 2028, you'll be flying nonstop around the world in a green hydrogen-powered airplane, Climate Impulse. Having achieved the first circumnavigation of the world in a hot air balloon and piloting the first round-the-world solar-powered flight, Solar Impulse, I mean, I think these were great demonstrations of what is possible in terms of harnessing renewable energy. But for me now, what's exciting about the new hydrogen-powered flight is it's really offering a tangible solution to decarbonizing air traffic and showing a way forward for the future of aviation will revolutionize how we fly. So tell us about the evolution of Climate Impulse and some of your collaborators in this project.
It's absolutely true that my previous adventures were more symbolic, because it's true that Solar Impulse, with this huge wingspan, very lightweight, quite difficult to maneuver, was a symbol, not really something operational to transport passengers. But the goal now is not just to revolutionize energy, like with Solar Impulse. The goal is to revolutionize aviation and to show that we can decarbonize aviation. We can make it more efficient. Of course, it's not yet a jumbo jet with hydrogen. It's a two-seater airplane, but I want to make the ultimate flight to shake a little bit the certitudes of the people. If we go around the world nonstop with two people on board, this project can become like a flagship of climate action.
Indeed. And you'll be flying low. It'll be a symbolist as well, but we'll be able to follow your progress. You'll have partnership collaborations with schools. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So the cabin will be unpressurized. We'll fly at 10,000 feet, roughly on the track of the Northern Tropic. So above a lot of land, cities, schools, universities, governments, where we can speak about restoring hope, bringing solutions. Because I'm so fed up of all the people who believe there is no future. It's too late to do something. It's useless to try. No, today we have to speak of solutions, not only problems. And to the people who say that they want to ban aviation because it's polluting, I want to say, let's make it clean. And this message of hope, I want to deliver it during this flight that will be around 9 days in the sky, but 4 years of preparation before we take off. So this is why it's already important to speak about that together in your podcast.
Yeah, so your optimism is infectious. Tell us a little bit about the design process. I believe it's been designed and now you're going into the manufacturing process. I mean, this is just very mysterious to me.
Yes, so it's a partnership I'm doing with a French navigator and composite material engineer who is called Raphael Dinelli. He was dreaming of doing that since years, me too. And when we met, we thought, okay, let's do it together. And we started working on it together 3 years ago already, with the help of Airbus, Daher Aviation, Cape Gemini, Ariane Group, making the rockets, and the European Space Agency. And all these big partners helped us for design, aerodynamic, energy propulsion systems, and so on. And at the end of last year, we thought, okay, it's possible. We can do it. We know how to do it. And we can now find big sponsors, big partners that will fund the project to launch it. And the first main partner who joined us is Syensqo, which is a spin-off of Solvay. They are making composite materials, solid-state batteries, fuel cells, insulation for the fuel tanks, and things like that. And we announced it very, very recently. good impact, very good response. People are happy to hear and understand that there are solutions for aviation, although we are at the beginning. But the construction now is starting. The first mold of the cockpit is under construction. So it's not only drawings. You have pieces of composite materials that are being molded.
It's so inspiring, the progress, because we talked about aviation a bit in our last conversation. You were talking about, oh, it's possible to be carbon neutral, which just with elements of carbon offsets. But this is really out of the carbon system entirely. And this will hopefully, I think, go towards then building a test batch. Because I believe, as you said, one of your partners, Airbus, they have a goal to have hydrogen airplanes by 2035. So this is really a first step in that direction.
Yes, exactly. And each time innovators and pioneers are setting ambitious goals, you have a lot of skepticism. You have all the people who think, oh, it's not possible. It has never been done like this. We can prove that it doesn't work. It will use too much energy to create the hydrogen. It will be too difficult to dispatch it, and so on. And let's look what happened in history. You know, in the beginning of aviation, there were scientists who were saying you cannot fly if you are heavier than air, because they had not understood the new paradigm of creating lift with speed on the surface. So you did not need lighter than air gas, you could just create the lift with speed on the wing. And then it was said, oh, you cannot break the speed of sound. And of course it was possible. And then you cannot go on the moon. Even now you have people who don't believe that they were astronauts on the moon. But it was done nevertheless. And we have to continue this disruption of aviation, showing always what we can do with innovation, with the genius of human mind and creativity. And Climate Impulse is one more step that will show that we can go further what people consider is impossible.
Yes. And talk about a little bit the engineering. So the hydrogen, as I understand it, has to be kept under minus 250 degrees.
Absolutely. But of course, before you have it in the tank at minus 253 degrees, you have to produce it. And you produce it by using clean, renewable energy, electricity, that goes through water to electrolyze the water. And it dissociates the water into a hydrogen and oxygen. You keep the hydrogen and you compress it, you liquefy it, and you put it in a fuel tank that is very, very well insulated. So it will remain in liquid states several days. But a little bit of it is evaporating. This is what you call the boil-off. And this boil-off is captured, goes through a fuel cell, and with the oxygen from the air, it reconstitutes water and electricity and gives back the electricity to the electric motor. So you fly electric with the energy stored in hydrogen, which means that you have absolutely no noise, you have absolutely no carbon emissions, and you have absolutely no pollution. You just produce water that the pilot can drink during the flight.
Oh, that's wonderful. And so down the line, then we might have short haul flights. I mean, maybe a long haul transoceanic flights is a little bit down the road, but there's also so many other applications with hydrogen and so many other aspects of industry and, of course, transport and all these things.
Yes. We need hydrogen for the steel industry, for the fertilizer industry. And today, this hydrogen is produced by fractioning methane, fractioning natural gas. So you keep the hydrogen and you release the CO2 in the atmosphere, which is really not good. So the goal is to switch from this dirty production of hydrogen into a clean production of hydrogen for the industry and, of course, for heavy mobility. I don't believe so much about hydrogen for light mobility because small batteries are more efficient. But if you have heavy trucks, trains, boats, planes, then it's too heavy to carry batteries, and hydrogen will be the best compromise.
And there's some speculation, of course, you have to guard against leakage. And how do you address that?
Hydrogen is not as dangerous as you think, because of course it can burn, but because it is lighter than air, if it starts to burn, it goes up immediately in the air. If you have kerosene or gasoline, when it burns, it's heavier than air and it falls on the ground. And you have this burning liquid everywhere that is inside the ground, and it takes sometimes an hour to get rid of the fire. So hydrogen, of course, needs to be contained in a absolutely tight tank. It needs to be well taken care of. But I'm really confident that we'll be able to do it. Now, of course, if the insulation is not made correctly, you lose hydrogen when it's evaporating, and there won't be enough hydrogen left for the end of the flight. And that would be terribly frustrating if Rafael Di Nelli and I were flying the plane and there are still 2 days to go and there was too much evaporation in the tank and you don't have any hydrogen and you have to land before the goal. That would be a failure, of course. But then we would start again with a newly built hydrogen tank that would be even better insulated. So the main quality you need for something like that is to avoid being afraid of failing. You need to say, okay, it might not be at the first time a success, but you need to try. And if it doesn't work, you try in another way. You change your paradigms, you change your strategy, you change the technology, and each time you improve better in order to succeed at the last attempt.
Yes, and you've also spoken, there's a possibility of suborbital flights. And I just think back to your grandfather, who, of course, was a pioneer and aviator. Just tell us about his story and going forward into the future of suborbital flight.
Absolutely. In 1931, the commercial aviation was flying low altitude inside the bad weather. It was not reliable. It was dangerous. My grandfather thought, let's try to fly above the bad weather in very high altitudes in the stratosphere in a pressurized cabin. So basically, he invented the principle of the pressurized cabin, tested it under a stratospheric balloon, and went 16 kilometers up. And that was the beginning of modern aviation, showing how reliable you can be, and also showing that in thinner air, you use less energy, less gasoline, because you have less resistance. So his concern was already about energy efficiency to save natural resources and pollute less. So that was, I would say, the first step. Now the second step for me would be to go above the stratosphere. So you could have an airplane built like a rocket with a hydrogen propulsion, but like a rocket. It's a mix of hydrogen and oxygen that is burning. It's not fuel cells and propellers and electric motors. It's burning. But it's burning without producing any CO2 because you have just hydrogen and oxygen. And this rocket plane would go in maybe 20 minutes to 80 kilometers, maybe 100 kilometers high. And then it could cut the engine and go parabolic in suborbital flight. And you can do half of the world in maybe 1.5 or 2 hours. That would be Paris-Sydney. You know, in so little time, in a clean way. And I know there are already some people thinking of it. The non-specialized people say, you are crazy, it will never work. But why? Why should we be negative like this? I think we have to encourage all these pioneers and be very careful, because if we are skeptical for new projects, once these new projects have succeeded, then the skeptical people will look really stupid, you know? So we have to be very, very careful before saying that something is impossible, because there are not so many things impossible. If you really change the paradigms, go into innovation, leave behind all your old beliefs and be open for the unknown. That's basically what I love in adventure, in exploration, in innovation. This is the state of mind that people must have.
Well, you definitely have that state of mind. As I say, it's infectious. And when you say it, I believe it. If others say it, I'm not sure. They don't always follow through. But you always have this great proof of concept, and that brings people along. And of course, your father, Jacques, was a notable pioneer as well. Your grandfather and father are really ahead of their time. And I remember you told me in 1972, your father had opened the first ecological institute, but it was before people were ready to even accept these ideas.
Yes. And my father was always very concerned about protection of the environment. And when he made the first dive ever to the absolute bottom of the ocean in the Mariana Trench, 11 kilometers down, it was to see if there was life down there in a time where the governments wanted to dump their radioactive waste in the deepest trenches. And the sight of a fish and a couple of shrimps down there was the proof that there was oxygen, and oxygen can only come from the surface where phytoplankton is doing it. So it was the proof that there was vertical currents between the surface and the bottom. And if you were dropping toxic waste down there, it would pollute the entire ocean. So it was a major contribution to the protection of the environment. And then my father built other submarines also to explore the lakes, explore the Gulf Stream, always with the worry of improving quality of life on Earth by fighting pollution. And he opened, I think it was the first European Ecological Institute, but it was a bit too early. People did not take it seriously. I remember he was speaking once with the mayor of a city, and that guy said, oh, we have no pollution over our city because there is always wind and it pushes the smoke to the other city next door. So that was the wrong understanding about pollution in those days. But maybe this is why I'm working so much now with the Solar Impulse Foundation on identifying solutions that can protect the environment. This is really the major part of my time that I'm dedicating to the environment today.
Yes, and it's not just 1,000 solutions now. I think it's over 1,500 or more.
Yes, absolutely.
I do want to talk about the new climate narrative. So in your book, Clairlise, Let's Be Logical as Well as Ecological, and your talks about paradigm shift, you've emphasized the importance of speaking with people in their own language, and you've called for a revolution in the way we speak about climate action in the new climate narrative, which you presented at COP28. What is the new climate narrative? And explain a little how you're working to develop collaborations with governments, institutions, and large companies.
It's a way to make ecology and climate action attractive, exciting, profitable, federating people together. Because today, we have to admit that it's not really very exciting to hear the common language about climate action and ecology. It's about very sacrificial behavior, degrowing the economy, renouncing comfort and mobility, something very expensive. Well, who wants to do that? And it's very strange that the people who want to protect the environment are not able to make their cause much more appealing. And this is what I try to do with the new narrative of the Solar Impulse Foundation, to show the opportunities more than the risk, to show the solutions more than the problems, to show that there are a lot of new professions that will appear, that it is not something expensive, it's a profitable investment. And maybe to summarize this change of paradigm, we're speaking of modernization more than decarbonization. Because if you tell countries they have to decarbonize, they're afraid that it will be detrimental for their economic development. But if you tell them you have to modernize, and if you modernize, you will have new infrastructures, new sources of energy, you will be more efficient so you can reach a better result by consuming less, which is, of course, much cheaper if you consume less energy, less natural resources. You have a bigger profit margin. So this is really appealing for the economy, for finance, for the industry, for the political world who wants to create new jobs. It is so appealing that they will embrace ecology if you present it like this. And then decarbonization will become the logical consequence of the modernization.
And you really give those actual real-world examples. There are different stages of development. Some of them are ready for market or some just need to be helped along. Can you tell us about your EU manifesto, Modernize to Thrive, and how does that build upon the ecosystem of the Solar Impulse 1000 solutions and the Prédevote draft law campaigns that you proposed in France and Switzerland?
In a lot of regions of the world, ecology starts to be hostage of political parties. You have the left wing who takes ecology as their flagship. You have the right wing who is fighting against ecology because they want to fight against the left wing and destroy ecology. And at the end, we're not moving fast enough in the protection of the environment and in climate action. So what we have done with the new manifesto for Europe 3.0 is to show how you can modernize Europe to thrive, how you can become more efficient. What are the investments you need? What are the new professions you need? What are the new technologies, solutions, sources of energy that you need to be modern, to be efficient, and to have a much better quality of life? but with all the arguments that can touch positively every party. Of course, it protects the environment, which is good for the ecology. But it's also good for the poorest people who have not enough money to pay for high energy bills. So if you modernize all the energy system, they will pay less energy bill. So it's good also for the socialists, for the left wing. Now you create new jobs. You have new companies being created. It's good for the economy. It's good for the center right. And then what is the far right asking? They're asking for energy independence, energy sovereignty. And if you are more efficient, if you import less energy from the outside, if you create more renewable energies inside the country, you are much more energy independent. So you see that you can find an intersection that benefits to all the political parties. And this is what we have published, because we don't know who's going to win the next European elections or the next American election. But whoever wins, left or right, ecology, far right, center right, socialist, whoever, they have to find a common advantage in modernizing the infrastructures, modernizing the country, becoming more efficient and more profitable for everybody, especially for a better quality of life.
So of those draft laws that you put forward in France and also in Switzerland, I believe three are being taken up: the urban geothermal energy, floating solar panels, and sustainable agricultural energy. And I think nine more are being proposed for the European Union.
Absolutely. You are very well informed. That's wonderful. It's true that we created this prêt à voter, ready to vote, with recommendations for governments and for the new law of encouragement to renewable energies from France. They incorporated three of our recommendations. One of them, for example, is the obligation for every constructor of a new building to have a study about geothermy to see if it is possible and profitable in his specific case. And when he has the report and he sees that he's going to save a lot of energy, it's going to be more profitable than a dirty old heating system, then the constructor will do it. So these tiny little changes in the regulations don't cost a penny to the government. It's not a question of subsidizing massively the geothermy. It's just a way to prove that it is possible and profitable. Also inside the city, not only for little suburbs. And we presented this also for Switzerland. This is under investigation. For Europe, also, we created a list of solutions for national energy and climate plans to help the countries of the European Union to be more ambitious in their roadmaps for climate action. We made also a very, very important solutions guide for cities. We took 180 examples of what has been done in different cities, but without being known elsewhere. And we listed all these success stories to show what the cities can use as new solutions to modernize and subsequently to decarbonize.
Yeah, it's really immense. Since we last spoke, go into the granularity of some of those 1,000 plus solutions. You now have an alliance that helps support this.
A World Alliance for Efficient Solutions.
Yes, and tell us about the Solar Impulse Runway Tool. That's a new development helping to facilitate clean tech investments, bringing research and innovation together to create viable commercial opportunities.
Yes, Runway is a tool that we have on the solarimpulse.com website to connect investors and startups who are looking for investments. So we have listed the innovators who are really looking for Series A, B, C, or whatever. How much money are they looking for? And investors can sign in and be in contact with these innovators and make business. Because at the end, what we need is to have the solutions being implemented. These innovators, they need to grow their company and bring these solutions on the market. And this is what we are helping to do. And because we have made this Solar Impulse Efficient Solution label, we can guarantee that all the solutions we have labeled exist today. They are scalable, they are credible, they are economically profitable, and they protect the environment. So it's a huge advantage to have this solar impulse efficient solution label with our 370 independent experts.
Yeah, the independent assessment is key. Going back to cities, of course, I know that creating smart homes, air quality and reduction of waste are the primary focus of your interests. And you explore that in the solutions guide for cities. So just tell us a little how you work with cities and how some of those suggestions are being implemented, or what is that process?
Yes, we have cities with which we have specific contacts, and we try to bring them the solutions that they need in order to modernize and decarbonize. And it's absolutely fascinating to see how many of these solutions exist. My wife, Michelle, has made at the Cité des Sciences in Paris last year an exhibition about solutions for cities. And she wants to continue this exhibition in Brussels in the second half of this year. And when visitors are coming, when mayors are coming, politicians or people responsible of public procurement, they are just amazed by the quantity of solutions in every field. You have systems to reduce the leakage of drinking water. Sometimes it's 50% of drinking water that is lost in the pipes. So a system to avoid this. You have systems for mobility to be much cleaner, to, for example, connect the car to the grid, to discharge the battery of the car on the grid when there is a peak of demand. And then when there is enough renewable energy, you recharge the car. So it's a car-to-grid system to balance the grid. You have systems to use the unrecyclable waste of a city to produce construction material, gravel or bricks. You have a system to build the big buildings with concrete, with some special steel staples that make the concrete much more compact. So you don't need to put all these iron bars to reinforce it. For agriculture, that's maybe not inside the city, but nevertheless, you need to feed the people of the city. There's a fantastic company that reproduces the molecules of the sexual smell of the insects. So they can spray the fields with this smell, and it disturbs the reproduction of the toxical insect, and they cannot reproduce anymore, but it doesn't kill the insect that you need to keep, like the bees, for example. So all these type of things, and I'm not even mentioning the LED light bulbs that are 20 times more efficient than normal bulbs, the heat pumps that can replace the polluting old normal fuel heaters and things like that. So when you really understand the quantity of efficient solutions that exist, you can only have hope. But of course, it needs to be implemented. And when you are saying that people sometimes are too focused, it's true. You have people who are thinking in silos instead of thinking in ecosystems. And they don't understand the importance of having electric cars for the public health. It's not only to decarbonize the transportation, it's also reducing the air pollution. So it's also maybe the public health budget that could invest into the electric chargers for EVs and things like that. You need to connect different departments, different ministries, different administrations together. Otherwise, nothing will change.
Yes, it's a lot of moving parts and requires so much discussion and meetings for decisions to be made and for new technologies to be adopted. Alongside this, with regards to the planet's finite resources, I believe you also have solutions relating to scaling up regenerative agriculture for the 21st century.
Yes, there is a lot of regenerative agriculture. You have special films that avoid the evaporation of water to keep the moisture in the ground. You have special molecules to avoid the seeds to be too dry when it doesn't rain. So it keeps the moisture around the seed. You need less fertilizers. You can use the waste from agriculture to make biogas or to make paper pulp. You have special food additive adjuvants that are absolutely natural. And it cuts 30% of the methane from the cows. And of course, you have the biochar. You know, this powder of coal that you can put on the ground and it's incorporated into the earth and keeps the carbon into the soil and at the same time makes it much more fertile. So yes, you have solutions for everything.
It's so heartening. And, you know, you were talking there about future-ready cities. And since we last spoke, you had discussed data centers and how efficiencies could be made in terms of the heat that they give off and the energy they waste. And now, since that conversation, we've had the rollout of generative AI, which consumes a lot of energy, but also offers a lot of opportunities, I think, in creating efficiencies, particularly in terms of future-ready cities. So what are your reflections on that and how we can harness the good and have governance against the other maybe negative aspects?
You have a lot of people today who are against AI, but 500 years ago, there were a lot of people against printing. When Gutenberg in Germany invented printing, a lot of people were against it. And now printing is obvious and it's important. But of course, you can print lies or bad pictures or whatever. So it's what you do with the invention that's important. And for AI, it's exactly the same. If you make deep fakes, I think you can destroy the trust and the confidence in the world because you will never know what is true and what is wrong. But if you use AI to balance the grid, to incorporate the renewable energies that are intermittent, the storage, the use by the consumers, then you start to be much more efficient because you use the energy at the right moment, in the right way, at the right place, for the right people. And you will save a lot of energy. So at the end, it's always the human behavior that will decide if an invention is good or not. What I would like really to avoid is that AI is used for useless things. You know, if you look, for example, at fully autonomous cars, and you really look how much energy it will use, how much data centers it will use, how many more satellites you need, how many more optic fibers you need, I don't think it's really not worth it. If the goal is to have video streaming faster than what the eye can see, it's a useless difference. So there is a moment where I believe we have to use the new inventions to really improve quality of life and not just to be happy because we have more technology. It's not the technology that will save the world. It is what we will do with the technology. And if we do it wrong, we can do a lot of bad with technology. So really, let's focus on the quality that the human being needs to promote a better quality of life. And also remember that we cannot have all the most modern and funny and fancy things in parts of the world and leave the other part of the world dying of hunger and thirst and living in miserable conditions. This also doesn't work. So we need to use the new technologies to help these countries to give access to electricity for populations that today have no access to electricity and they live in terrible poverty. But for example, if you install a microgrid with solar cells, with a battery, with a pump, with the plugs, you can irrigate, you can have people developing local business. They pay for the microgrid with their telephone, a pay-as-you-go system, and you develop a completely lean and local economy with wealth and health. This is what we need to do with technology. It's also for the quality of life of the poorest people that we need to care.
And just following on that, for someone who cares deeply about the individual experience, what are your reflections on the future of education and AI? I mean, what do you see down the line?
You have the brain and you have the heart, and you cannot feed only the brain without feeding the heart. So feeding the heart, that means creating authentical relations between people, educating the children to have compassion, to have empathy, to have respect for others, for nature, for animals, for other human beings. And of course, you need to feed the brain, to work with different languages, to know how to read, how to calculate, to know where to find the information. So you need both, but I'm a bit afraid today that we feed only the brain and not the heart. And when we want to put these Neuralink implants in the brain, we forget that there is the heart where maybe we should also work a little bit more.
It's a pleasure to speak with you, Mr. Picard. My name is Catherine Gross, and I'm a climate reporter from the United States. You've discussed in detail the relationship between profitability and ecology, particularly within your qualitative growth model. I would like to know, how do these concepts relate to current conversations about how to most effectively distribute international aid to countries immediately vulnerable to climate change?
You have mitigation and adaptation to climate change. Adaptation is when you are compensating the problems that already occurred. If you have a sea rise on a flat land, of course you need to make some dams to avoid the water flooding the entire country. This is what we call adaptation, and we need to do adaptation, of course, but adaptation is very expensive because you need to compensate the problem. What I'm really promoting today, in order to avoid, be obliged to adapt to all the problems, is to try to mitigate the problem upfront and reduce the CO2 emissions, reduce the waste of energy, reduce the waste of natural resources in order to be more efficient. And this part is profitable. It's economically profitable because if you use less energy to obtain a better result, you spend less money. And the money you save, you can use for the investment in the upfront of your solution. So I'm really pushing to do more mitigation, more climate action, in order to avoid, to be able to repair all the problems we did with the adaptation.
Speaking of limiting waste, you've addressed in your book as well how we should aim to be less materialistic and limit our waste, even if that seems impossible. Are there any practices that you could recommend to our audience, perhaps specifically for my own generation, Z, on how to limit personal consumption?
Absolutely. Well, the first thing at the individual level is the recycling. You can recycle paper. You can recycle metal. You can recycle glass. We start today to be able to recycle plastic to make new plastic. And all the waste of food has to be limited. And what you cannot limit, you can use for the compost. That means to put it into regenerative agriculture. So waste at the individual level can really be solved if you are respectful with what you consume. And at the industrial level, you can use the unrecyclable waste that are left to make construction stones, to make gravel, to do whatever. And a lot of waste can go into energy. So this is something we have to do. Now, about reducing consumption in general, it's true that we buy too much in our parts of the world because other people have no money to buy anything. But the one who can consume, they consume too much. It's a high quantity with a low quality. And what we need to understand is that this is expensive for us and it's polluting. If you buy these t-shirts from Asia for $2 or $3 and they are destroyed after you wash them twice, it's expensive. You much better buy something a bit more expensive that you keep for longer. And this is what I call the qualitative economy. The quantitative economy is when you consume more and more with a cheaper price and it's worst quality and it doesn't last and you have to buy it again. But in the qualitative economy, you buy the quality, you buy the efficiency. And of course, you can do it yourself, but you also need the help from the governments. For example, a mobile phone should not have a guarantee of 2 years and they fall apart after 2 years and 1 week because they have programmed obsolescence. No, a government could say, from now on, we make it mandatory to have a guarantee of 5 years. It means that the people will consume half of what they consume normally in terms of electronic items. They save money, and the producer can sell less, but with a higher price to compensate. So he makes a higher margin, and the consumer makes a saving margin. And like this, you pollute less. But this is why you need people who understand the situation to do it in the way they can. And what they cannot do at the individual level, the governments have to do it and put a regulation in place that really promotes quality, promotes efficiency instead of quantity and cost and pollution.
Yes, you point to the dark side of consumerism and fast fashion, where it now takes around 700 gallons of water to produce one t-shirt, like you mentioned, and 2,000 gallons of water to produce a pair of jeans. The sad thing is 85% of those textiles end up in dumps each year. But what's exciting is now the idea of a circular economy, which once seemed like a distant utopian ideal, is gaining traction and could finally become embedded in our lives because it's just common sense. The question is, I guess, how to implement it.
It can be implemented very precisely if the legal framework is modernized as much as the technology is modernized. Because today, all the solutions are available, but you are still allowed to use old systems that are inefficient and polluting. Even if it's more expensive, you have people who say, oh, I'm so much used to what I have that I'm not going to change. You have people who still have normal light bulbs that are completely inefficient because they are too lazy to change them and put LED light bulbs. So there must be a legal framework that is today really bringing the incentive legally to go for efficiency, to go for clean solutions, to go for modernization, and to ban all these things that we are using today that were invented 100 years ago. And that are still really outdated, polluting, and inefficient. And we need this legal framework to evolve. It's not a question of having the governments being too interventionist. No, it's really setting the frame in which we are obliged to evolve. Because there are so many people who don't evolve if they are not obliged to do it.
Yes, because you've often said that people don't want to change. They want other people to change. And I love to see how you implement your background as a doctor into bringing people to where they want to go, but they prefer to see someone else go there first.
Absolutely. I've been working as a psychiatrist and psychotherapist for 20 years. And it was so obvious that there were people coming to my practice because they were suffering in their life, but they wanted the outer world to change. The others, they did not want to change anything themselves. And what do you do then? You need to inspire change. You need to give the confidence in change, the wish to change. And you need to show that it will be better after than it is now. And this is completely lacking in the ecological policy today. What are the ecologists showing? A society with less freedom, with less traveling, with less comfort, where it's expensive to protect the environment, where it's sacrificial, where it's boring. And this kills the wish to change. Of course, the people who are ready to make a sacrifice, it's wonderful. I admire them. I thank them for their devotion for the environment. But it's a small minority. And by doing what they do, they prevent the industry, the economy, the financial world, and the political world to change, because they don't want to change. They want to keep what they have to fight against ecology. So what I want really to do is to inspire this change by showing a world that is more efficient, more modern, better quality of life, more profitable results also for the economy and for the industry, because they can go into new business opportunities to sell efficiency, to modernize, to replace what is polluting by what is protecting the environment, to invest into all these new solutions, new companies that will grow, creating jobs and making the world clean and efficient without needing this sacrifice that frightens everybody. So we should really use the rules of psychotherapy into our world. And unfortunately, today it's exactly the opposite.
During the interview, Bertrand Piccard talked about how science has learned from its previous misconceptions, as well as some of his family's contributions to the field. His projects, like traveling the world in a balloon or developing a vertical axis wind turbine, are fantastic and push the bounds of our imagination in an attempt to demonstrate creative solutions to energy or climate change related issues. But in some way, they also remind me of other historical scientists' work during the Age of Exploration, or Da Vinci sketches. Society tends to think of science in a contemporary light, But oftentimes, our past understandings of the world can inspire creative solutions in the present. Many climate scientists attempting to reduce global emissions have returned to the low-tech methods and inventions of our ancestors. In August of 2023, a cargo ship was fitted with a giant set of sails called wind wings to cut fuel consumption and shipping's cargo footprint. While at first glance the project might seem like a retreat back to the 18th century, these sails are made with the same material as wind turbines, so they're more durable and efficient. But inventions at Mr. Picard's own Solar Impulse Foundation, scientists are also thinking of creative solutions with roots in older methods or technologies, such as increasing crop yields by monitoring biodiversity using bees instead of drones or pesticides, or a large optical periscope that efficiently harnesses and distributes daylight indoors. Many scientists and governments are also working with indigenous scientists or populations to learn about their traditional methods of regenerative agriculture. Like the economy or nature, discoveries can also be made in a cyclical pattern, and it makes sense that we look to our low-tech past for inspiration for our low-tech future. And now, back to the interview.
Yes, and we should say that the environment itself is naturally a closed loop. It's naturally a circular economy, which you have experienced in your travels.
Yes, in the beginning, I was speaking about the beauty of nature, the magic of life on Earth, the importance of protecting everything that is around us. And I was maybe a bit naive, and I was thinking it was enough to protect the environment. Of course, it creates a lot of applause when you speak about the beauty of the nature that you have overflown with your balloon, with your solar airplane or whatever. But it changes nothing because the language of the key decision makers is not the language of the beauty of nature. It's the language of profit and job creation and developing the economy. Of course, you have people who are against the capitalism and they say, oh, those are nasty people. They destroy the environments by greed and they want to be rich. But although you can say that, it doesn't change anything because the one who have the power, they are the people from the economy, the finance, the industry, and the politic. So you need to say much more about nature than just the beauty of life. You need to show that it's also a business opportunity. I'm sorry to say that. It's not to promote capitalism, but it's to convince the capitalist that it's also in their own interest to do it and take all these new businesses, invest into these new solutions, implement these solutions, save money, create new businesses, new business models. For example, for finance, there's a really interesting business model today where you do not sell the ownership of a clean infrastructure, you sell the use of it. So for example, for people who don't have enough money to put a heat pump in their building, or to buy an electric bus in a village, you have the investors who pay for the system, they implement it, and the client is only paying the use of it. They pay the kilometer of the electric bus, they pay the calories produced by the heating system or by the cooling system. And like this, it allows everybody to have it. And because it's efficient and profitable, they can pay back progressively by the use of the system. So it's new business models for the banks, for the investors. It's not a sacrifice. It's a new opportunity. And all these things we have to understand when we go into circular economy. You create much more jobs and you make much more than linear economy where you throw away the thing at the end. Because when you reuse it, recycle, upcycle, give a second life, transform it, it's new business opportunities, it's new industries. Like, for example, the industry of recycling of lithium-ion battery. That's a new business. It is much more profitable than to throw the battery in the landfill.
Yes, and speaking of our single-use throwaway habits, plastic pollution has become one of our most pressing environmental issues. Every year, we're producing around 430 million metric tons of plastic, most of which becomes waste after single use, and it's expected to double by 2050. How can we better deal with the short life of disposable packaging and reduce the manufacturing of unnecessary single-use plastics?
Of course, you have situations where one-use plastic has to be banned. You have some completely stupid things where you have boiled eggs without the shell who are wrapped into plastic protection. Let's keep the shell, natural shell, instead of the plastic protection. It's much better for boiled eggs. So it's ridiculous. You just need to ban these type of practices. Now, in other systems, you cannot ban the use of plastic because it is maybe cleaner, it's maybe lighter, it's maybe more hygienic and things like that. And in this case, you need to introduce a system that recovers this plastic and retreats it or recycles it. And it's possible. There is a beautiful example in Austria. The government said to the industry, you have the choice. Either we put regulations about all the waste that you produce, or you take over the responsibility of your waste and you do something with that. And the industry said, okay, we do it ourselves. They created the Austrian Recycling Association, AHA. It became a new industry for managing the waste, and it's an industry that is today economically profitable. This is what we have to do. It's an incentive from the government. It's the implementation by the industry, and it's economically profitable, and you don't have any more the waste that are thrown everywhere in nature. This is the type of things that are clever. Unfortunately, there are a lot of non-clever people who are making the rules, making the laws or whatever in this world, and they don't have this vision about the importance of the decisions that they should take. And unfortunately, there is still this fantasy that you are sometimes better re-elected if you have done nothing, that if you have taken the risk to do something. This is a pity.
You know, these solutions, they're good for the economy, but of course you've seen how landscapes that have adopted them thrive when they're not being polluted. To just tell us about some of those stories.
Well, you have, of course, the beauty of nature everywhere. Beautiful to remember all these memories that I've seen from my balloon, from my solar powered airplane. When you have a sunrise over the desert, you know, when you have this completely black curtain in front of you, and then you suddenly have a little silver line on the horizon, and then the silver line becomes bigger and bigger, and it's the entire sky that is silver. And suddenly the sun arrives, and you have the red color thrown everywhere on the desert that becomes red, and you are like the witness of the creation of the earth. It's gorgeous. When you overfly the clouds in the morning, they are very small on the ocean and they grow and they grow. And then when it's become colder in the evening, they start to melt down and disappear, like if they were living creatures, but it's vapor, water vapor making the clouds. And then you have the forest. But when you look at the forest, you also see the madness of people. With Breitling Orbiter 3, the balloon, during the round the world, I overflew the island of Haiti and the Dominican Republic. On the side of Haiti, there was not a single tree visible. And exactly on the border between Haiti and Dominican Republic, you had the forest starting. Tropical, very dense forest. And there you see the beauty of nature, and you see the madness of the people who have just destroyed nature. And this is not only in rich countries with the industry. It's also poor countries because they are so poor that they need to burn the wood. So you see, it's a constant contrast between the beauty of the world and the madness of people. Or sometimes what people are obliged to do when they are in a war, when they are in extreme poverty. And of course, we have to address this part of human life also. It's not only about protecting the environment. It's also about giving to people a decent quality of life, because this extreme poverty is not only morally unacceptable, it's also very dangerous. Very dangerous. When you look at Haiti today, it's not only forests that have been destroyed. It's a civil war due to poverty. And it's like this in a lot of countries everywhere in the world. And then you have the wars that are made by our need to have natural resources. And you have to understand that there are really some psychopathic people who make wars intentionally to sell their weapons. They make civil wars here and there so they can get cheaper natural resources for their business. So we should not believe that human beings are perfectly honest, compassionate, and a beautiful creature. You have beauty, nature, but you also have tsunamis, earthquakes, volcano eruptions where nature kills people. And you have also in human nature, beautiful minds and sometimes very, very dangerous psychopaths that are destroying the region where they are living and where they are ruling. So that's the contrast. You know, in the world, everything is dual. Everything that is created is dual. You have good and evil. You have night and day. You have left and right. You have white and black. Everything is dual. And we have to understand that and try to deal with it.
Yes. Well, thank you for the honesty of your realism and for helping us harness that duality within ourselves and in the outside world. It's been so inspiring. You open up our horizons. So thank you, Dr. Bertrand Piccard and the Solar Impulse Foundation, for exploring the future and inspiring us with your work and insights and showing us what is possible for the next frontier of clean technologies and green aviation, and just for sharing your passion and pioneering spirit that we can create better futures. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you for your invitation to share my passion.
One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Catherine Gross with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Katie Foster and Catherine Gross. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Gagne. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, drop us a line at team@oneplanetpodcast.org. Thank you for listening.